Money laundering is the support industry for terrorists, fraudsters, kleptocrats, cartels, people traffickers, all the things that are undermining civilization, democracy, everything that we like. All of those things are supported by money laundering.
That's Oliver Bulo and his conclusion.
And the important thing to recognize is that what we have right now has failed. The system that we have has failed and is failing and will continue to fail unless we radically change it or replace it with something better.
I spent 30 years inside that system, first as a DIA intelligence officer, then as a DEA special agent. Oliver Bulo has spent his career writing about it. We agree on the diagnosis. This is cease and desist. Oliver Bulo is the author of Moneyland, Butler to the World, and his newest, Everybody Loves Our Dollars. He's one of the few journalists writing about financial crime who genuinely understands the operational reality behind it, not just the politics. When I read his work, I recognize cases I've worked. I recognize frustrations I've lived with for decades, from tracking Hawala networks in Dubai to following Bitcoin trails on the streets of South Carolina and Italy. What I didn't expect going into this conversation was where he'd land on the question of solutions. His single biggest prescription isn't more enforcement, isn't better crypto regulation. It's something so low tech, it almost sounds like a joke until you hear him make the case. One thing we should say, this is a podcast about chasing dirty money, not about managing clean money. Nothing here is financial advice. Now, here's Oliver Bulo.
Thanks. Really good to be back on the show and really good to be talking to you. I'm actually quite hoping you're going to be sharing a few of your own stories from particularly tackling the Hawala trade-based money laundering networks in the Middle East and elsewhere, I suppose, because I do think that that is a really underexplored, underexamined aspect of money laundering. I worry that often our understanding of money laundering is stuck sort of in the 1980s. You know, it's almost like we watched Miami Vice and just thought that's how money laundering is and how money laundering always will be. And we didn't realize that this is a global and intensely entrepreneurial and dynamic industry. And it is an industry which adjusts like any other industry to the regulations and the constraints put upon it. It's constantly looking for new markets, new ways to be more efficient in the service of its clients. And those clients are, you know, the worst people in the world. Money laundering is, you know, it's a sort of odd crime because it's a crime that only exists because of other crimes. It's a sort of almost a kind of meta crime. But it is the support industry for terrorists, fraudsters, kleptocrats, cartels, people traffickers, all the things that are undermining civilization, democracy, everything that we like, all of those things are supported by money laundering. So our government's failure to, I mean, even constrain money laundering and the ability of money launderers to do their work quickly and cheaply is something that is making lives miserable everywhere. And it's something that deserves to get a lot more attention than it does. So yeah, really looking forward to our chat and looking forward to hearing from you as well.
Well, you know, so let's just hop right into it then, Oliver. You know, one of the key issues, and I think you talk about it across all your books, is the gap between money laundering and the public's perception of the urgency in addressing money laundering. I oftentimes, when I'm out speaking now and can speak a little more honestly than I could when I was in active service, use the comparative point of, as a DEA agent focused on global drug flows, we used to often get criticism for, oh, how effective is DEA or any drug investigative agency? You know, international entities barely seize 20% of the global drug flows. Then I learned, once I really became involved in money laundering cases and asset recovery, that international entities barely seize 1% of illicit assets and proceeds. So do you think that the public's perception and the inability of politics globally to address that 1% is largely because people don't understand money laundering at its core?
Yes, I mean, I think it's important to put that 1% figure into perspective before getting stuck into the meat of the question. I mean, we don't actually even know it's as much as that. I mean, the amount of money that is laundered globally is sort of something of a mystery. You know, the estimates that have been made since the 1990s and that continue to be made now tend to place the volume or the size of the global illicit economy at somewhere between 2 and 5% of global GDP. That's a huge range. You know, I mean, the global GDP is about $100 trillion, give or take a bit more than that. But, you know, so that's between $2 and $5 trillion being laundered globally. You know, that is a massive amount of money to not be sure about. And so if it's at the top end of the range, maybe it's significantly less than 1%. But whether it's 1% or 0.1%, in a way, it doesn't matter. That is a failure of a huge scale, considering the amount of time and effort and money that is being spent on compliance, on attempting to comply with the laws being put in place to tackle financial crime. It is, you know, the cost of global compliance is, according to LexisNexis, something around $200 billion annually. Just to say, is that a big number? You know, with $200 billion, you could solve world hunger. You could provide clean water and sanitation to everyone on Earth and have about $50 billion left over. It is a colossal amount of money. It is totally failing to solve the problem that we're trying to solve. And that is a huge failure. Governments are demanding that private sector companies spend a lot of money to tackle this problem. And they are failing essentially to give the right directions to those private companies to do the job. It is a little bit, I mean, I use the example in my book, it's a little bit like expecting an army to march into war without knowing where the enemy is, who the enemy are, or really what the enemy are doing. That's what it feels like. We are completely ignorant about the nature of the problem. And so what I was trying to do with this book is just to map out, I suppose, the boundaries of that ignorance, to say, here's what we know, here's what we don't know. Why don't we know it? Here's, look at all the things we should be looking at that we're not looking at. And it is easy in a way to say that it's a problem that the government fails to do this. But, you know, then in a way, why does the government fail to do this? Well, the government doesn't do it because the people, voters aren't demanding they do it. And why do the voters not demand it? Because journalists and others have failed to make the case that this is important. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to make the case that it's important and hopefully persuade a few people to write to their representatives and say, come on, let's do a better job.
You brought it up, so I'll dig right into this, because this was a topic that truly intrigued me as I studied and researched your themes that you touch upon in all your writings. You called the AML compliance world an army that doesn't know who it's fighting, where it's fighting, when it's fighting most of the time. I'm ACAM certified. I've got my CAMS anti-money laundering certification. So I'll own your critique from the inside. And why I say that is something that drove me completely crazy during my career was this tendency of governments and agencies to separate illicit finance into its own discipline, its own category, where separate actors and actions were performed and were performed in order to investigate the same criminals, the same transnational criminals that traditional investigators were investigating. And that caused a lot of siloed action. What would it actually look like, in your opinion, to know who you're fighting, when you're fighting them, and doing it together in a concerted effort with an idea of mission in mind?
Yeah, I mean, it's really good question. And I think that framing of mission is the really important one. And it's thing I want to come back to. But I think it's important, just to, before getting to that, to briefly address the question of why this is happening. Why is it that, unusually for, you know, what is essentially often a national security challenge, particularly around illicit finance coming out of places like China or places like Russia, this is not just a criminal challenge, but a national security challenge. Why do we not have a proper coordinated response to it? And in a way, you could trace this all the way back to the foundation of the Financial Action Task Force and the decisions that were made, you know, in a really short period of time, just a few months at the end of 1989, when, you know, a few representatives of a few members of the G7, it wasn't even all the members of the G7, made some very rushed decisions about what action against money laundering was going to look like. And the decision was made then, largely at the instigation of the British delegation, that they were going to rely on private sector companies to report suspicions to the authorities, that you would essentially be outsourcing the intelligence work to bankers at that time, but later bankers and other professionals, to spot suspicious transactions, to report their suspicious transactions. And then having done so, the authorities would look at the suspicious transaction reports that came in. And essentially what they were doing, although they didn't call it this, was outsourcing the law enforcement response. They didn't want to have to go through the mountain of paperwork themselves. They didn't want their law enforcement agencies to be snowed under. So they thought, we'll just get someone else to do that. And that hasn't worked. Outsourcing law enforcement, particularly to the private sector, never works because the incentives are all wrong. You know, if you are a profit-making company, you're not particularly interested at the deepest level of whether you stop crime or not. You're just interested in whether your profits are harmed or not harmed. And that is the core problem, and I think the core flaw in all of our efforts, on which everything essentially that we've built subsequently has founded, because you cannot build a decent structure on weak foundations. And so with that in mind, if you bring it forward all the way to now, why are we failing to tackle these issues with a sort of mission? Because we're not, these are not joined up bodies. You do not have law enforcement agencies, intelligence agencies, parliament, investigative bodies, whatever, all of them working together, because quite a lot of these bodies are just fundamentally different. They are profit-making companies, which are not, you know, working in the same way as police agencies or intelligence agencies or whatever. So, you know, where we have seen efforts that have worked in the past. And I have an example in the book when I talk about what's often referred to as carousel fraud. It's a particular issue that afflicts European countries because of the poor structure of the value-added tax regime in the European Union. Carousel fraud was something that was a massive problem in the UK in the early 2000s. And it was dealt with, I mean, almost entirely successfully, not completely successfully, you can never eradicate it completely, but pretty much completely successfully by taking an approach that's radically different to the approach that we take normally to tackle illicit finance. It was dealt with, like you say, with a mission attitude. Everyone was contributing. It was a diplomatic question. They had to deal with other jurisdictions. It was an intelligence question. They needed to collect intelligence on the criminals. Yes, it was a law enforcement question. They needed to prosecute people, but they also needed to change the law to make sure the law worked properly. All of these things work together, pulling together, you know, at all times, you know, in a really well designed and well coordinated campaign. And why it's a really interesting and I think instructive episode, and something which deserves, I think, more credit than it gets as a law enforcement and government operation, is that normally the campaign against illicit finance simply doesn't work like that. You know, we have very large numbers of private companies, banks and others, who are filing colossal numbers of suspicious transaction reports, you know, in the millions every year, into law enforcement agencies that simply don't have the capacity to read them all or respond to them in any way. There was a report a couple of weeks ago in the UK about the National Crime Agency, about how their software system, which they're using to tackle illicit finance, is 15 to 20 years old. You know, we have this mad situation where the big financial institutions are using now, you know, really cutting edge artificial intelligence to tackle, to spot for the red flags that are indicative of money laundering, filing gazillions of suspicious transaction reports, which are then going into law enforcement agencies who are trying to tackle them essentially with sort of version of Windows, which is, you know, 15 years old or whatever. I mean, it is, the mismatch is extraordinary, but it is, you know, indicative of a thing whereby governments have expected private companies to do an awful lot of work, have fined them massively if they've failed to live up to those very high standards, but then have the governments have not demanded the same high standards of themselves. And so that, I think, is at heart why we're failing, because we have not had this joined up, as you say, mission approach to tackling financial crime and illicit finance. And governments, frankly, have not been doing the work that they should have been doing, or living up to the standards which they claim to demand of others.
So do you think if that onus that was placed on private enterprise, especially in the financial sector, to monitor illicit flows and create the, you know, significant activity reports or suspicious activity reports, excuse me, there should be more of a feedback loop there? If that onus is going to be placed on them, should governments come back once they see that SAR and say, yeah, tell me more about that? Do we need the issue process in order to dig deeper from the governmental side? Or is it, does it need to be scrapped altogether and looked at in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, it's not really, what's really interesting is actually I spent a bit of time in the British government archives looking at that first Financial Action Task Force meeting in 1989, There was actually, in that file, there was a letter, a very early letter from a British bank to the government reporting a suspicious transaction. I don't know whether this was essentially the first suspicious activity report or you know, may have been even before they were formally existed. And in the file was also a complaint from the bank that they hadn't had feedback about that suspicious activity report. You know, the failure of governments to provide feedback to SARS is baked into the process. And it's impossible really to imagine how you could provide adequate feedback to hundreds of thousands or millions of SARS. The sheer volume of intelligence that's being poured in now is pretty, I mean, it's just impossible for anyone to respond to. I mean, I think what we need is, to be honest, a complete rethink of the situation. Because, you know, you have this, particularly in the financial sector, you know, this now incredibly sophisticated compliance machine, which is attempting to detect the tiniest of red flags. And, you know, whether they're succeeding or not, we don't really know, but they are definitely employing a lot of people and throwing a lot of resources at trying to solve this problem. But criminals are not stupid, or at the very least, top-end money launderers are not stupid. They can see where it's easy to launder money and where it's hard. They can tell where they're likely to be caught and where they're not likely to be caught. So if you have a tremendous amount of fortification around one part of the economy, they're just going to move their money laundering activities into a different part of the economy. You know, we see now huge crypto companies, which are, in terms of their reported market capitalization, far more valuable than almost all but the very biggest banks, which employ perhaps a couple of hundred, 300 or so people in the whole company, let alone in their compliance department. Yeah, these are companies more valuable than major banks, and yet their compliance department might be a 10,000th of the size of major banks. So obviously, if you're going to be moving illicit wealth globally, you'd move it via crypto rather than via a bank because you're far less likely to be caught. And then if you look at the trade network, which is even less regulated still, you can pile a load of stuff into a container, ship it from one side of the world to the other and then sell it, and you're almost certain to get away with it. So obviously the criminals are going to choose to move their wealth through these under-regulated or less regulated parts of the economy rather than the best fortified parts of our defences. And this is, in a way, the challenge is, how can you somehow shore up the defences of those other parts of the economy to keep criminal wealth out of them without gumming up the global economy altogether? Which is, you know, if we had checks on the global trade network, anything like commensurate to the checks we have on the global financial network, then it's hard to imagine how anything would ever move at all. So to go back to your question, yeah, we need a complete rethink, really, of what this looks like. Maybe this global system, the Financial Action Task Force-based system of having the same standards for everyone, maybe it's not possible. You know, maybe in reality, that is not something that can be done. Maybe we need to have a more, you know, mission-oriented approach at a local level with each government deciding for itself what its priorities are. Maybe that's what we need to do. But it definitely needs to be different to what we have now, because, you know, we have been banging away of attempting to do this FATF-based global standard approach for certainly since the late 1990s, and I suppose since 9/11, again, differently because of the terrorism finance aspect. And it's been a complete failure. You know, I mean, just talking about terrorism is noticeably not got less since 9/11. I mean, the Taliban are back in power in Afghanistan. You know, the system that we have has not worked. So, you know, that has to be the start point that we have of recognizing that what we have built has failed. And if you do that, do you just radically reform it, or do you replace it with something altogether different? That's a different question. But you need to recognize it's failed before you can do anything at all. And I don't think that recognition is nearly widespread enough.
Do you think that these issues surrounding all anti-money laundering efforts of governments globally that want to do the right thing, or at least on the surface want to do the right thing, do you think part of that is a result of, to use your phrase, baked into the idea that governments have this over-reliance on bureaucratic solutions? They use an analog algorithm that worked well enough before criminals scaled their enterprises using sophisticated technologies like they use today. And then they're using the same techniques from 1975 today. And the world's completely different. Do you see it as that? Is that part of the exacerbating problem?
That's definitely part of the problem. I had a lot of fun in researching this book, in going back to the beginning of anti-money laundering legislation, just following the train back to the origins of the Bank Secrecy Act in the United States. I mean, it's a bit of an odd term that's called the Bank Secrecy Act when it, I mean, that's A, not what it's called, and B, it's a bank Transparency Act rather than a Bank Secrecy Act. But anyway, that's what everyone calls it. So let's just go with that. You know, the author of that act was, you know, a very far-sighted man, Wright Patman, unjustly forgotten representative in the House of Representatives from Texas. Really interesting guy. You know, but he was responding to the reality in the late 1960s, which was a very different world to what the world is now. I mean, it had some things in common, but it was a far slower form of finance. It was first that piece of legislation was first then implemented in the early 1980s in Florida. The criminals responded very, very fast, found ways around it, which sort of defanged it. And yet we haven't really had the same kind of root and branch consideration of what we're doing that they did back when the Bank Secrecy Act was first conceived of. And that's something that we definitely need to do to respond to the digital reality that we now have. But in your question, you suggested that governments want to do the right thing, and very definitely parts of governments want to do the right thing. But I don't think that there is across government a recognition that this is a battle that affects everybody. Illicit finance is not just a question for the banks or not just a question for law enforcement, but for any part of government that is attempting to improve society or to protect society needs to be concerned about illicit finance. And the thing, or one of the things that frustrates me most of all, is if you look at, you know, what is the single most useful tool for criminals to evade restrictions put in place to stop them laundering money, that tool is the banknote, cash money. Still, you know, despite everything, despite all the advances in technology, now, as in the 1980s and the 1960s, if you want to hide your wealth, move your wealth in an unaccountable, non-transparent way, the easiest way to do that is to use cash. And if you look at the statistics for the production of banknotes globally, particularly in the United States, but not only in the United States, it is astonishing how the volume, the value of all the banknotes in circulation goes up and up and up and up. In the US, it doubles every decade and continues to do so, and has continued to do so for the entire time I've been alive. If you look at the statistics, that doubling in value is almost entirely accounted for by a doubling in the value of all the $100 bills. The other banknotes, they barely move. They have increased a bit, but really not very much. $100 bills, however, just keep going up and up and up. And where are they going? Who wants them? If you're trying to use $100 bills to buy coffee in the US, people look at you a bit funny. In the UK, we have £50 notes. £50 notes you hardly ever see. They're really not particularly useful. And yet last year, the Bank of England printed tens of millions of them. You know, where are they going? Who are using them? Why do central banks, they are part of government. They should be part of this effort to tackle illicit finance. Why don't they stop and think about the mix of the denominations they're printing and recognize that there is really only one big source of demand for these colossal values of high denomination banknotes? And the European Union does this too with a 100 euro bill and 200 euro bill and so on. You know, and that source of demand is criminals, for the very least, in the grey economy. And, you know, if we are all in this together, if we're all tackling this together, then, you know, you need to start with the lowest hanging fruit, not printing high denomination banknotes and not giving criminals a very easy way around the restrictions being put in to try and stop them is the obvious thing to do. And yet the fact that this isn't even being discussed, in fact, not only is it not being discussed, but the US is currently talking about printing a $250 bill, is incredibly irritating.
And that's one of your main points, or at least one of your main prescriptive solutions, is reducing, eliminating big banknotes. And the other one is discussion of regulatory framework around crypto, like real meaningful regulatory framework around crypto. So with crypto, moving into that, let's discuss that a little bit, because I think it's that technology piece that has left governments, so to speak, in the dust in terms of the capability matching the scale at which criminals are running their operations. And for me, I saw early on in my career when I was looking at Hawala networks and I was looking at that intersection of traditional finance, Hawala networks and trade-based money laundering, particularly in that era, it was in Dubai. It was the one place in the world where you had a Hawala shop sitting next door to HSBC. And that was not coincidental, you know? And so the reality was we needed to scale ourselves into some level of technology to track both the human coming in about the Hawala piece, but also the dollars. And back then it was every currency in the world in in Europe because the euro wasn't out yet. And the only way to really do that was to try to have some kind of technology solution that we could insert into the system to help us track it, because the volume of information flowing, and this is mid-90s, was so great we couldn't keep track of it. And I found that the government's response initially, because there was a lack of trust for the private sector, was to try to build its own solutions, its own link analysis software, its own internally created database software. And it fell on its face. And that was the age of the information boom, the initial phase of the information boom. And I found that, you know, solutions often come from the private sector, firms like Chainalysis, firms like Penlink. And I'll just put a plug because the sign's right behind me, firms like Asset Reality. Do you think there could be a sea change in thought on truly outsourcing these technological-based challenges that criminals introduce into the equation and governments have trouble responding to? Do you think technological firms could step in and bridge that gap to make governments and their enforcement efforts more effective?
Before we answer that question, now in its third year, Seize London has become the meeting point for the people shaping how governments seize, manage, and dispose of criminal assets. On the 24th of September, 2026, we'll bring together the decision makers driving the future of seized asset management for a day of frank, in-person discussion and networking that goes beyond the surface. Seize London is a free in-person event. Head to the Asset Reality website to register your interest now. We look forward to welcoming you. And back to the episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to recognize before I answer that, although obviously crypto is growing incredibly quickly as a solution to help criminals move their wealth quickly and easily and cheaply around the world, whether that is the cartels in South America, whether that is fraudsters in Southeast Asia, whether that's the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, whoever, you know, crypto is incredibly useful for them and a real problem. And we see this as developing all the time. You know, I've been writing a piece, which hopefully is coming out quite soon, about the Russian cryptocurrency A7A5. The Russians found difficulty using US dollar denominated stablecoins, so been using USDT. They were frozen when a chunk of USDT was frozen at the Russian crypto exchange Garantex under pressure from European and American law enforcement. They quickly pivoted to using their own stablecoin, which is outside of Western control. This is developing all the time, and it's a real problem. But it's not an either or. You know, we have seen these cash for crypto money laundering operations happening globally, whereby, you know, the oldest form of money laundering by using cash is meeting the newest form using crypto, and the two systems perfectly complement each other. It is a new form of hawala, trade-based money laundering, which is much quicker. You don't need now to ship handbags around the world or used cars around the world. You can just move crypto around the world. And it is deeply, deeply troubling and very, very hard to tackle. With regard to involving the private sector, absolutely. I think that there is a lot of really foolish squeamishness about tackling money laundering, which we need to get over. This is an important challenge, and it's a challenge that requires everyone to pull together. In the crypto space, yes, companies like Chainalysis, Elliptic, and so on have done really extraordinary work. But I think it's important to recognize that we mustn't repeat the same mistakes that we made in essentially deputizing banks to do all the reporting of suspicious transactions. Private sector companies cannot be the only answer to this problem, because they are, if you are profit-making companies, then your interest is not in stopping crime, it's in making money. And so they need to be supplemented at all times by much better resourced law enforcement agencies who are given the political cover and the resourcing they need to do the work in terms of tackling financial crime. And this is a, you know, particularly with regard to crypto, this is a real problem, because, you know, since the very beginning of efforts to stop money laundering, we've been very reliant as a world on the United States taking the lead. The United States passed the first rules against money laundering. It's done most of the big investigations. It's levied the biggest fines on the banks and so on. But what we are seeing with the current administration is a real willingness to just open the floodgates for crypto, to allow it to essentially grow unhindered and unchecked in ways that are really, really troubling, particularly, I think, because of the close business ties between big crypto companies and, you know, family members of the administration, which do suggest, well, it certainly gives the appearance of potential wrongdoing in a way that's really worrying for anyone who wants to have a well-resourced and well-intentioned regulatory regime, because we're just not seeing that. So other countries really need to step up and to do it quickly. We need to see European countries really appreciating the urgency of the situation and stepping up and filling the gap which has been left a little bit by the retreat of the United States from this front line.
You hit the nail on the head with one of the other themes I want to talk about. You framed the issues and the problems around global anti-money laundering efforts as political failure, not operational. The money is global. Whether anybody wants to admit it, no matter what narrative you subscribe to today, money moves globally. It's the euro, the dollar, all kinds of other currencies. They're constantly moving around, and you often have cryptos and other e-currencies bridging the gaps. But the enforcement is national, sometimes local. You sometimes have a local cop in St. Louis, Missouri, investigating an international organization laundering money out of four different foreign jurisdictions. So in your opinion, is the fix to globalize law enforcement somehow, or to nationalize finance in another by another effort? Is either actually possible? And along those lines, is the problem understood and well diagnosed enough? And it's really just a matter of calibrating a proper response that would require support of the political entities in play.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. The challenge since globalization, or this new wave of globalization, began back in the 50s and 60s, the challenge is that money is global and government, democracy, law enforcement is local or national. That's the problem. And trying to find a way of squaring that circle politically is incredibly challenging. You know, like you say, what is better, nationalizing money or globalizing law enforcement and by extension globalizing democracy? Neither of those is an easy thing to do. But I do think there are aspects of this that need to be dealt with more quickly than others. The question of crypto is really a question of privatized money. It's sort of dressed up in lots of, you know, folderol around blockchain and, you know, and all that. But basically, this is who controls money. Is it controlled by democratically accountable regulators and central banks, or is it controlled by rich people? That's really the question. And particularly with regard to donations into political processes and democratic campaigns, it's really important that that remains done via national currencies, which are controlled by democratically accountable regulators. Because if it's privatized money, then essentially all bets are off. Everything can be bought. And that's a real challenge. So, you know, I think we need to divide this up into priorities and to try and prevent essentially an oligarchization of the political system. Because if that happens, then we end up with, you know, no possible solution to tackling illicit finance. So, you know, I am deeply suspicious of crypto. I don't think it's really the answer to anything. I don't think that genie is going to be put back in the bottle, but I think it needs to be, if it is going to exist, it needs to be kept under very tight wraps with particular regulations to prevent the outsized exercising of influence in political processes. I think that possibly too late in the United States, you know, considering the size of the crypto super PACs, which are putting money into the midterms. I mean, hopefully that's not the case. But in other countries, I think that there is definite possibility of trying to nip that in the bud. More broadly, I do think that, you know, if we look at the example once again of carousel fraud as a way of tackling illicit finance, you know, that was a national effort. That was no one. There was diplomatic efforts to coordinate with other countries, but it was done nationally within the United Kingdom. And I think that you could see more efforts like that done within countries to try and use all the powers that a country has to tackle particular challenges. But it requires far more political engagement. It requires a lot of thought and care and attention. And that is what we have been lacking, really, in terms of the response to illicit finance. But, you know, I just think we need to remember what's at stake. We're talking about millions, hundreds of millions of victims of crime, of trafficking, of the cartels, of kleptocrats, every year. We're talking about, you know, the Russian drones bombing Ukraine or whatever. Any challenge that you can think of which involves the movement of illicit wealth would be made better if we could make it harder for people to launder money. That's the aim. And the important thing to recognize is that what we have right now has failed. The system that we have has failed and is failing and will continue to fail unless we radically change it or replace it with something better.
I can tell you, having worked real cases where drug dealers profited astronomically, first off, misery as much as oftentimes deaths of others, I maintain that illicit money is equally as guilty as the actors and the commerce that generated it. To me, the fruits of the crime are as culpable as the criminal actors who perpetrated the crime in the first place. To me, I believe that recovering maligned assets should be as important as a prison sentence meted out to the criminal who generated the assets and reinvested into the public good. So to me, asset recovery is an important part of this continuum. And you know, that's one thing that Asset Reality is focused on, really, is asset recovery, enabling governments and agencies to get involved in asset recovery. Do you see it? I know it's an idealistic viewpoint looking at an asset in the same way that you look at the actual criminal who generated the asset. Do you see a space for that? You know, a point of optimism of possibly that reimagined anti-money laundering global effort?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about an asset recovery is it's as what you'd call in rugby a 14-point swing. If you can take something away from someone and give it instead to the good guys, then you are degrading the bad guys' abilities and commensurately improving the good guys' abilities at the same time. I mean, it's a complete no-brainer. And there is a real disturbing lack of attention that's paid to asset recovery. And I think, again, I mentioned earlier this sort of foolish squeamishness around particular ways of tackling illicit finance. One thing I think the United States is very good at is having whistleblower payment systems, rewards for whistleblowers to help people, persuade people with the information needed to bring cases against criminal assets, to come forward and provide that information to the authorities. You know, we need to see far more of that willingness to roll your sleeves up, to work with people, even people who you might not particularly want to work with, in order to get the bigger picture, which is to deprive the criminals of the assets that they have earned through their criminal activities. You know, this is all of a piece with the central mission, which is trying to reduce the size of the criminal economy, because by doing that, you will reduce the number of victims of crime. That's the goal. And anything that can make that happen is good. And yeah, absolutely, asset recovery is central to that, because yeah, by depriving criminals of their wealth, you are depriving them of influence, and therefore by reducing their role in society.
So let's talk about your new book a little bit, Oliver, here as we're rounding out our time together. Does your book offer some answers? Is it a diagnosis? And out of those two categories, what would you like most for policymakers to take from it and action into law?
So if I could click my fingers and do one thing, it would be to have a global agreement that all the major countries would stop printing high denomination banknotes. That is the single thing that would do the most to make money laundering harder. I mean, it sounds like depressingly low tech, but in terms of how criminals operate, banknotes remain central to their operations. Beyond that, you start getting into questions around transparency, questions around proper resourcing of law enforcement. And none of these things are particularly sexy, and often they are hard work. But if we have proper information available to law enforcement agencies, but also private sector with transparent information, then it's much easier to see who owns what, who's doing what, how the criminals are hiding their wealth. That kind of work is ongoing and constantly opposed by people with wealth to hide, but it's incredibly important. And having produced that information, whether that's transparent corporate registries or trust registries or whatever, having produced that information, we need to have properly resourced law enforcement agencies who can look at it with the right number of well-trained people with good political cover who are able to bring cases wherever they will take them. You know, and this is going to be hard, but the prize on offer is, you know, a world with less crime, and that's a better world. That is something that would make civilization preferable. So, you know, these are small things that we need to do, and it's going to be a constant uphill battle because you're going against the influence, the interests of a lot of wealthy and powerful people. But I mean, I find it very frustrating that essentially I've been saying again and again, you know, since I started writing about financial crime, essentially the same solutions. People always say, oh yeah, of course, it's all terribly sensible, and then nothing ever happens. So this time, all I'm essentially just, my wish list is just one thing, which is to end high denomination banknotes. That's what I would like to see most of all. And once I've done that, I'll move on to other things.
That might be a lot easier than trying to get some kind of uniform regulatory framework around crypto that would make apples to apples passporting of a currency that not everybody understands and probably never will understand.
I think you're probably right.
But truthfully, in my law enforcement career, I can't tell you the number of times we would just see huge caches of currency. I was part of a case. It wasn't my case. It was somebody else's, but I helped with it. If you remember years ago, there was a Chinese chemical supplier that was shipping precursors to the cartels in Mexico. And the Mexican police found $750 million behind false walls at a house in Mexico City. And those were all high denomination banknotes. And it all started there. And I can only imagine what his plan was to kind of on-ramp that into the layering stage or at the placement stage, and then ultimately layer it back to whoever he owed that money to.
It is astonishing to think, though, that in the regular economy in the United States, now fewer than 15%, 1/5, of transactions are done in cash. That is, it's falling all the time, and that is a marked reduction from just 5-6 years ago. And yet, despite that, demand for dollar bills is so healthy that they're building a whole new factory in Maryland to keep up with demand. So where is the demand coming from? If any other company was producing something that was so useful to criminals and yet apparently so undemanded by the formal economy, any other company that was doing that, they would be under investigation by the federal authorities. But because it is the federal authorities that are doing this, no one thinks anything about it. So it is a really important question that everyone should be asking. And this isn't just to beat up on the United States. This is exactly the same thing is happening in the European Union, the United Kingdom, in Canada, Australia, and many other places. But it is the misuse of large denomination banknotes by criminals is ongoing all the time.
Do you think legislation would potentially change that? For example, I remember years ago, probably in 2007, 2008, there was legislation on the floor of Congress to make any drug crime globally in which the act was negotiated in dollars an offense in the United States. So for example, a drug transaction between Southeast Asian syndicate and a South American cartel that didn't mention the United States, but they were negotiating in dollars, could potentially be charged in the United States as a drug crime. Do you think something like that, a robust extraterritorial statute, would eliminate the connection between physical currency and crime? Or do you think that's just a band-aid to one part of the problem?
I mean, I think it goes further than that, which is that profits... Yeah, I mean, this is a simplification of the situation, but it's not completely inaccurate. Every year, the United States exports something like $100 billion worth of $100 bills. That's according to the Federal Reserve's own estimates. That means that in terms of an export industry, the $100 bill industry is a bigger earner for the United States than pharmaceuticals. It is a colossal industry and very, very profitable, in that printing a $100 bill costs almost nothing. So that challenge of how do you willingly forego those profits is the challenge. And the same is true to a lesser extent, but still true of other big printers of globally accepted currencies. If it is so profitable for central banks to print banknotes, how do you persuade them to stop? And the way to persuade them to stop, in my opinion, is to point out that although there are profits to be made from printing banknotes, they are nothing compared to the harm that is done by the criminals using those banknotes. So if you net it out, this is a net loss, not a net gain. And that's, I think, the argument that as journalists and as others as interested parties, you know, we have the responsibility of making that argument all the time, of saying that you're only looking at one side of the balance sheet. You need to not only look at the profits you're making from printing banknotes, but also look at the harm that is being done by the crimes that are facilitated by those banknotes.
So yeah, it goes back to one of our earlier points that we began our discussion on, that visualization of the connection between the money being laundered and all of the predicate offenses, from human smuggling to drug smuggling to online fraud to pig butchering, all of the things that connected to it, is exactly where our political leaders, who ultimately would be the ones who'd have to change laws and address these issues, should be looking. That's ultimately your prescription, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's where we need to get to. And yeah, and this is it's about telling stories and getting information to the people that need it.
Well, Oliver, this has been fascinating, man. I've really enjoyed talking to you and seeing it from an investigative journalist side versus an investigator side. It's amazing. And I really appreciate the insight that you've provided today.
Thanks very much for having me on the show. It's been really great. And yeah, hopefully one day or soon I can come again.
Yeah, we'd love to see you. And I'm looking forward to getting through your whole book. So once I do, maybe I'll have another discussion with you. A huge thank you to Oliver. His new book, Everybody Loves Our Dollars, is out now. And if this conversation scratched the surface for you, the book goes much deeper. If the problems we talked about today, seizing, recovering, managing criminal assets, are problems you're actually wrestling with, that's exactly what Asset Reality was built for. Reach out at assetreality.com. Join the movement. Change the paradigm underpinning asset recovery. Follow the show. We at Asset Reality, where asset recovery is our only mission, look forward to your next listen.
Cease and Desist is produced by Lo Furner and edited by Tobias Furner. Our podcasts are for informational purposes only. They are not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice. Listeners must consult their own advisors before making any decisions on the topics being discussed.